argument case today is Cox v. Gilcrease Well Corp. et al., case number 59721. Counsel ready to proceed, Mr. Cox?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Attorney Bruce Cox for appellants, Leo Fangus and Todd Leventhal are also present.
Okay, thank you.
To give the court a timeline on this situation, the defendant, Gilcrease Well Corporation, was formed in early 1972 as a non-profit cooperative, basically a farmers cooperative association, to distribute irrigation water to farmland. There was approximately 500 acres of land having irrigation rights that was transferred to that corporation in return for approximately 50 shares of capital stock. The articles of incorporation did not provide for stock assessments, and Nevada statutes don't. Coxes were not one of the original shareholders in this corporation. We were second or third of the line down. We purchased 10.2 acres in about 1974, and we were to get 1.024 shares of stock. In other words, one share per 10 acres, roughly. We didn't get that stock certificate until 1995, 21 years later. But although this period of time, no one contested our rights to use water, and we did use the water as irrigation farmland, on the irrigation farmland. At the time that we were finally issued the shares of stock, we had trouble then. They only wanted, Gilcrease Well Corporation only wanted to issue us one share, and the hours of irrigation time you got depended on the number of shares you had. So ultimately, we did get the 1.24 share, but we had a problem there too. In April of 1998, let me back up. In August of 1995 was when we were issued the certificate for 1.024 shares. Ultimately, from Frank Martin, who was the president of Gilcrease Well Corporation and the trustee of the Martin Family Trust, signed over us a stock certificate for an additional 2.21 shares to Cox's. Out of a bankruptcy, Cox's had purchased another parcel of land, and there had been a lift stay allowing a foreclosure of that property. Frank Martin, not being aware of the bankruptcy, had prior to then purported to purchase such 0.21 shares, which, because there was no lift stay for that, that was an invalid transaction. Anyway, Frank Martin, on behalf of the trust, endorsed that certificate over to Cox's. Cox's sent the certificate back, requesting to be put in Cox's name. And in response, we got a letter from Mr. Martin that in essence said, I'll just quote a little bit from it. And there's a copy of that at the appendix 1007. That basically said, it's not customary to reissue a new certificate when the one you are currently holding has been properly transferred and witnessed on the back. Then it goes on, Gilcrease Well Certificate Number 80, which you dropped off, has already been properly transferred to H. Bruce and Suan Cox on the back. There is no need to waste another certificate and expend more time on something which is unnecessary. the core issues of this case is whether or not a three-year statute of limitations bars the Cox claim. A summary judgment was issued stating that the claim had to be brought within 3 years because of the conversion. And we have argued that under the discovery rule that any statute of limitations would not even commence until we had reasonable, that we knew or should have known that they were not going to issue the stock. The letter that I just quoted from should equitably stop Gilchrist from making such a statute of limitations argument, or as an alternative, the statute of limitations under this discovery rule should not start running until Cox's had knew or should have known that their rights were not being honored. And up until June of 2007, Cox was allowed to use their irrigation rights. In June of 2007, Cox has paid the last assessment against stock, and payments of the assessments were under protest because Cox has said you have a nonprofit cooperative association can sell its product, but it isn't a country club. It doesn't make assessments. It shouldn't make assessments. But we paid that, but refused. Well, we said we refused to pay any more until we get the stock that was issued to us. Now, in addition to the 0.21 shares, there was a approximately 18-acre parcel of land, part of the Gilchrist farmlands, that had 1.9 shares, and Cox has had an undivided 5% interest in that. And when that land was sold, the water rights were specifically reserved, including stock in Gilchrist Well Corporation. And it was, and as part of the sales transaction, part of Cox's consideration, because Cox still had other farmland there, all those water rights were transferred to Cox. And those shares were, that 1.9 shares was mailed to Gilchrist in August 15th, 2003. Those shares were never reissued. They apparently were reissued, but they were not delivered back to Cox's. And up until June of 2007, Cox continued to use the irrigation water rights until Cox says, we're not paying any more assessments until we get our shares of stock. I mean, I'm getting old enough, I need to do some estate planning and getting stocks in. Well, anyway, but that's where the crisis kind of elapsed. Now, the ironic thing is that they have argued that they converted the stocks and that Cox's claim is barred by a three-year statute of limitations. I have here a copy of the most recent annual assessments. They continue to make assessments. And one assessment, and it's dated June 1st, 2013, it's the annual assessment. And in addition to this, they make monthly assessments too, what they call pump fee. But they made one shareholder assessment, then assessment for 1.32289 shares of stock, which would be on 1.024 shares that was issued in Cox's name, the 0.21 shares that Cox has got from Martin, and approximately 5% of the 1.9 shares. Also mailed to Cox's were two additional assessments. It was addressed to First Security Trust for Edward Corse, but mailed to my address. The other one was First Security Trust Company for Darwin Lamb, mailed to my address. and that likewise made one shareholder assessment plus an assessment on 0.90155 shares of stock for each of them. So I submit that even under the discovery rule, that as long as they're making assessments to Cox's, they're recognizing Cox's ownership of those shares of stock. We probably need to know how we got to this situation.
Mr. Cox, before we get into that, you have, if I understand the record correctly, two remaining claims for relief in the district court, right?
Is it even have not been ruled on?
Yes, sir.
No, there are no claims remaining. The lawsuit was originally brought by the Goms to enforce a sale by Judge Glass in Department 5 that didn't comply with statute, was beyond the 5 years, and the Supreme Court ruled that that was an invalid sale. And so this lawsuit was then filed thereafter by Frank Martin to enforce the sale that was declared invalid. The Cox claims, the Cox and Goms claims were all settled by a settlement. Cox had also claimed 0.17 shares of Gilcrease that we had purchased from my sister. But in the settlement with Goms, I found out that Gilcrease had in fact converted that 17 shares and reissued it to Goms. I agreed that Goms could keep that 17 shares, and additionally agreed from my 1.024 shares to convert them 0.32 shares. But all of the causes of action of the counterclaim have been resolved. The summary judgment purported to retain jurisdiction over the ninth cause of action, but that ninth cause of action is on the 0.17 shares that had already been issued to Goms, in which we agreed they could keep. So there's no causes of action.
But has the court entered an order dismissing the ninth cause of action? The record before us indicates that the ninth cause of action is still alive and well, and at least even if, as you indicate, as between you and Gilcrease and Gone, you have eliminated the subject matter of the ninth cause of action, the record appears as though the district court hasn't acted on that yet.
That part is true, but I've cited cases regarding finality that if there's nothing left to resolve, I was in a rough situation. I would rather have the court tell me that you filed a notice of appeal too early than that you filed it too late.
But
your observation is correct. There has not been an actual court ruling saying the ninth cause of action is dismissed. But there is nothing left to resolve under it.
Is there another cause of action that still exists there? I understood there was one other cause of action. Was it the 10th? That's still active?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor.
So the only one that you're aware of for which no order has been entered, at least, is the ninth.
The ninth cause of action. The summary judgment it calls itself a partial summary judgment, but
right.
It purported to reserve jurisdiction to rule on the ninth cause of action. And I filed a notice of appeal because there was nothing left to resolve on it.
Because the settlement with Gone then,
yes,
resolved the 0.17,
yes,
acres.
The 1.7 shares of stock.
Shares, yeah.
I said that wrong. 0.17 shares of stock.
Right, right. A lot of fractional shares going on here.
They should have issued more shares of stock instead of getting into the fractions, but that was done before.
The reason I asked you this is paragraph 2 of the judge's order of July 12, 2011, which is record 912, says the Cox's first cause of action seeking declaratory relief and ninth cause of action for determination of ownership of capital stock are dismissed on the basis that Gilcrease will comply with this court's order if Gilcrease is ordered to transfer ownership of stock in Gilcrease. Did Gilcrease file anything with the court indicating that it would comply?
No, they have not complied, and as far as I know, they haven't filed anything with the court.
Okay.
To comply with the court, Cox has deposited the 1.024 shares into escrow, and the escrow could not get Gilcrease to commit to reissue 0.32 shares to Don and the remaining 0.70 shares to Cox's. The perpetual problem of Frank Martin getting control of stock and not wanting to give it back. That July order was probably superseded by the October 17th order, but just purported to reserve jurisdiction of the ninth cause of action.
Okay. All right, Mr. Cox, thank you for your argument. Mr. Flansburgh.
Frank Flansburgh of Marquis, Arbach Coffin, on behalf of Responding Gilcrease Well Corporation. May it please the court.
Do you agree with Mr. Cox that the Gahn settlement addressed the 0.17 shares and he acknowledged that?
Not exactly, Your Honor.
What's contested? If the settlement has resolved it as between you and Gahn's, and he's acknowledged that, why isn't that subject matter final?
The subject matter is not final because the stock certificates themselves, as called by the ninth cause of action, is to assign ownership for the responsibility as it relates to those stock certificates. In the settlement agreement to which Gilcrease was not a party in whatsoever, non-negotiations or otherwise, that settlement agreement requires stock certificates to be transferred free and clear of any assessments or any liens related to those certificates. That was an issue that was could presumably be resolved by court order between the Coxes and Gahns as to who bears responsibility, if anyone, for that. And that issue was then brought to the district court to transfer them free and clear. And Gilcrease's position before the district court was that, sure, we will follow whatever rule is, whatever order is made by the district court related to those shares, but there is an issue outstanding that has not been resolved, and that is the responsibility for the assessments that are owed on the certificates themselves. And the settlement agreement purports to address that, but again, we weren't party to the settlement agreement, and the court did not make a determination concerning those assessments, whether, one, they would be due, or two, whether or who would be obligated to pay them.
So I didn't understand Gilcrease filed a counterclaim in this case.
We didn't, Your Honor. But
you haven't raised the issue. You haven't put the issue in front of the court, the responsibility for payment of the assessments.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit.
It may be an outstanding issue, but have you asserted that against Cox's or Gahn's?
May I please, Court, there are two responses, if I may. First, on the legal basis, you're right, we did not make a counterclaim. That's correct. But from Schmidt v. Sadre and also Shetland v. Railron, if there is an issue that arises by a logical inference from the pleadings and the general denial, it's an issue for the court to determine below. The court has jurisdiction on that. In this case, you have the fifth, which later became the ninth cause of action related to the determination of stock ownerships. You also have the 11th claim for relief concerning the applicability of assessments that were all denied. So the issue is before the court. Moreover, Your Honor, in the very opposition to the motion for summary judgment that's part of the record here, Exhibit CC to that motion contained a letter from Gilcrease Well Corporation to Mr. Cox alerting him to the fact that these shares had assessments that were due and a lien was being asserted by Gilcrease over those stock certificates. So Gilcrease's position, Your Honor, is yes, there is no counterclaim. But by logical inferences from the pleadings, there was an issue that had to be resolved. Now, submitted that the district court could make the determination that perhaps that was not an issue before it, or perhaps that there were no obligations to pay those assessments, or whether those assessments are even due. We would submit, though, that the district court was deprived of the opportunity of making that determination, which renders that order not final.
And I'm perplexed because you haven't put it officially an issue through a counterclaim. Mr. Cox says, I don't care anymore. I'm walking away from this 0.17. So there's no issue for the... Who would put this in front of the district court? What would the district court decide? Well, Mr. Cox doesn't care. Gone's gone from the case, and you haven't sued for it. So what would Judge Gonzalez do?
Well, Your Honor, let me, if I can perhaps address that in a nice manner. The issue between the ownership of the stock certificates between the Gahans and the Coxes, there is, by implication, there an issue with respect to who has obligations for those assessments to Gilcrease in the Gahans and Coxes dispute between them. Because if they're arguing over the transfer of certain stock certificates, then the obligations that are due on them are part of that subject matter to be resolved between them.
Now, they aren't. They settled.
Well, yes, Your Honor, you're absolutely right. They did settle, but they settled without including Gilcrease at all. And we submitted to the district court, as we do here before Your Honors, and that is that whatever order the district court made with respect to those shares, we would follow. The court didn't make an order. The Gahans and Coxes agreed to a settlement to deliver these stock certificates free and clear. All we did was raise the issue. That didn't resolve all of the issues because there is an issue with respect to the potential assessments. The court didn't make a determination that assessments were actually due or if they were timely assessed or who bore responsibility for it. But what the district court reserved jurisdiction for was to make that determination, which it never had the opportunity to do, which renders that order, which was enforcing the settlement agreement.
Mr. Flansburg, I guess maybe my question is poorly worded. What would be the procedure that would put that question about who's responsible for paying allegedly owed assessments in front of the district court judge? Mr. Cox is no longer making a claim to the shares. He and Gahan is settled and Gahan's gone, so to speak. And you have a counterclaim for it. So what would be the procedural mechanism by which the court could resolve whether or if and how much the assessments are on those shares?
The procedural mechanism by which the court would address it is more complicated for me as well. It's either part and parcel of the ninth cause of action. I think that's where it lies. The ninth cause of action is for the determination of the ownership. As it relates to the Cox and Gahans, they were disputing the ownership as it related to those shares. Part and parcel of ownership of those shares are responsibility for those assessments. The Cox and Gahans took that issue unto themselves and decided that those certificates would be divided among them. And in that agreement, the Coxes agreed to deliver them free and clear. Well, they're not free and clear, and that was the only issue that we raised. And that was part and parcel of the remaining ninth cause of action pursuant to the order for partial summary judgment. So I think the procedural mechanism, Your Honor, is simply either a summary judgment or a trial on the merits as it relates to that ninth cause of action to determine who, if anyone, bears responsibility for the assessments on those stock certificates.
Yeah. Does the record show how much those assessments are?
Yes, in the motion to enforce the settlement agreement and the opposition thereto, there was some discussion with respect to the assessments. From my memory, Your Honor, I believe they were less than the $100,000 deposit, but they were greater than $50,000, if I recall correctly from the record. But yes, they are part of the record as it relates to the motion, our objection to the enforcement of the settlement agreement, and Mr. Cox's reply.
So you're saying that, and as Mr. Cox acknowledges, there's no court order resolving the ninth cause of action, So if some motion were brought by someone either to dismiss the ninth cause of action or to adjudicate it under Shetler, the court would necessarily have to resolve the assessment question, even though it's not the subject of a cross-counterclaim by you guys.
Yes, Your Honor, that would be our position, and I think that's...
It's a little complicated for me to understand, so...
There are many parts of this case that are complicated when we get into the fractional shares, but I think that the issue really came down to is when you look at the ninth cause of action, it's all ownership rights related to the stock certificates. So part of those ownership rights, part of that bundle of sticks, are the obligations for those assessments. So that would have been resolved in a dispute between the Guns and Coxes as to who has responsibility for that, and the court could have made an award of damages to one party or the other related to those stock certificates. The Guns and Coxes, I would submit, complicated the matter for Gilchrist somewhat by settling that case on their own, settling that issue on their own, and then made a determination essentially that the Coxes are bearing responsibility for that by delivering them free and clear of any assessments. So when the motion to enforce the settlement agreement was brought, the limited objection was made by Gilchrist as it relates to resolution of that one claim. And I would submit, Your Honor, that I believe that the precedent has been pretty clear, whether it's ALPA or ALEC, whether it's resolving ministerial acts of receivership costs, or whether it's resolving an interest in retirement funds, that if the order leaves any further issue to be determined by the district court, no matter how ministerial or housekeeping in nature, the order is not final until it's resolved. The only thing that should be left for the district court for the order to be final and appealable are fees and costs. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
Yes, I guess then that's the reason that the order by the judge of May 21st, 2012 holds up the distribution of the $100,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
I was curious about the way it was worded. It's going to be held up unless those issues between Cox and Gilchrist are resolved by arbitration, mediation, or litigation.
Yes, Your Honor. Those were the words from the court that I believe is reflected in the record that were then included in the order.
But that language is intended to address the outstanding question of assessments under the ninth cause of action.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Unmistakably so.
I see.
And I think that issue renders the order incomplete and not final for consideration by this court respectfully as a threshold issue.
Okay. Assuming that the court, this panel, disagreed, then what's your view about this statute of limitations argument that Mr. Cox has made to us today?
The statute of limitations, Your Honor, I think it's clear that the best practice would have been to include an affirmative defense in the answer or seek amendment prior to raising it in the reply. However, I think Cottonwood Cove and Shetler both stand for the proposition that you can raise the affirmative defense on a motion for summary judgment or even on a motion for a rehearing such it was in Shetler, so long as there's no prejudice to the other party in the sense that as long as it was addressed below before the district court, then there's no prejudice attaches to use the language of Cottonwood Cove. In this case, I would submit that no prejudice attaches for a few reasons. One is the statute of limitations defense was always part of the case in the sense that the Gons had included in their affirmative defenses, and a co-defendant may attest some persuasive authority out of Alaska that suggests that you can rely upon a co-defendant's affirmative defense because it doesn't prejudice the plaintiff. The plaintiff is unaware of it. Second, we extended the opportunity for additional briefing on that issue, which was declined by the Coxes. And finally, third, most persuasively, I think, which is directly in line with Shetler, is the fact that you had a motion for rehearing argument and 39 pages of arguments all about the statute of limitations. With respect to the timing of it, the demands related to the fractional shares were all made between August 2003 and November 2003. Additionally, the point Only one of seven shares for Roman Scott were assigned to Mr. Cox in May of 2004, but the record is that they were demanded by Roman Scott for division back in 1999. So that's the timing of those shares. With respect to the assessments, Mr. Cox had raised objections related to the statutory violation 78.195 back in 1995 by correspondence, which is part of the record, and again in 1997, and again in the early 2000s. Considering that the 10th and 11th claim for relief that talks about the share certificates and the assessments were brought on December 11, 2009, really, no matter which statute of limitations you apply, those claims would be time-barred. The court applied a fraud statute of limitations because that's how the claims were pled. But this idea of discovery and the fact of notice really is a moot issue because these issues are clearly evidenced by the record in 2003 and prior as early back as 1995. So I would submit that the statute of limitations wasn't waived because it was argued down below, so no prejudice attaches, and that no matter which statute you really apply, considering that the claims are made in 2009, that the claims are time barred.
Okay. My colleagues have any questions?
Any questions?
All right.
Thank you for your time, Your
Honor. All right. Mr. Fox, Mr. Flansburgh, thank you for your time and your arguments in the case, and we'll stand submitted.